It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. Mm-hmm. As we begin the program, I do always like to remind you, do not hesitate to make that phone call. It's a simple phone call. No cost. Just make the phone call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. Go online to their website if you'd like to find out more at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, good afternoon to you, Cecil. Good afternoon to you, Wes.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Cecil, good afternoon.
Cecil.
And we lost Cecil. No, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
So, good afternoon, everybody. Lockwood, last week, Wes and I discussed various aspects of estate settlement. We at Harvell and Collins do concentrate in estate settlement. And, of course, Wes then concentrates in a very growing and aggressive area of the law called fiduciary litigation, where spinning off from either a power of attorney agency relationship or from a executorship, there is litigation concerning any a myriad of different issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are the first, Lockwood, this may surprise some of our listeners. We are the we see appointments every day where after the appointment, we tell the client or during the appointment that, you know, ma'am, we would love to help you, but you really can handle this. We'll be here for you to dot an I or cross the T, but you go on over to the clerk's office and open up this estate. You really will be able to handle it.
Right.
You have a last will and testament. The last will and testament looks acceptable and is legal under North Carolina law. You have the original of the document. I'm reviewing it right now. The beneficiaries are in agreement with you being the executor. You've already been in touch with the beneficiaries, and things are looking very straightforward for everybody. And so I really think you will be able to handle this. And so we do have a percentage of files where Wes and I go ahead and direct the executor, the client, on over to the superior court and specifically to the clerk of court to handle the matter. However, that is not always the case. And there are many, many files where folks maybe potentially will begin the case with the clerk of court and then run into complications.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one of those cases yesterday, actually. So we're going to kind of talk about some complications that can happen at the clerk's office when folks are administering the estate.
All right. So I'm wondering, when that happens, Cecil, is that something that the clerk of court will simply say, okay, this is getting more complicated, or is it, how does this,
That's
develop?
What happened yesterday.
Okay.
With a nice lady who came in from the Beaufort area.
Uh-huh.
She had actually opened up her aunt's estate herself.
Uh-huh.
And it was under administration with the clerk's office. They ran into some significant problems, primarily with some real estate holdings.
Mm-hmm.
And the clerk of court told her that, ma'am, at this point, you really are going to need to get some assistance from a lawyer. So she came in yesterday, and she does need some assistance. It's rather complicated, and we're going to have to get to the bottom of it for her. So there are certainly cases where, or circumstances where, the clerk will refer the client to go seek a lawyer. Now, the clerk isn't going to tell them to go see a specific lawyer,
right,
because that's just not appropriate. But we'll just say, go find yourself a lawyer and have your lawyer report back to us. So that's what happened there. Wes, of course, is going to speak to us about a case that's a little bit different, where actually, Wes, the client was very concerned about some of the things that the clerk of court, and we won't say whether this was Carteret or Onslow or New Hanover. Right. We do work, by the way, in all of eastern North Carolina counties, and even right now I have an estate pending in the western part of the state. Wow. In the mountains of North Carolina. So Wes and I are licensed in the state of North Carolina. We're able to handle things in any of the 100 counties that exist in the state of North Carolina. So we won't spell out which clerk in which county this dilemma occurred, but this does happen from time to time that the client is coming in because they just are not understanding exactly what the clerk of court did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the county issue, of course, you know, Lockwood, we have cases really all over the state. We have, you know, a fair number of states that we deal with in Wake County. I've had multiple hearings there. I've had litigation cases in Wake County now, Mecklenburg County. You know, from an efficiency standpoint, you know, sometimes we're referring those cases to someone else. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to, you know, drive and there may be some expense for the client, you know, for us to deal with the case.
Right.
That's a long way away. But that's kind of on a case-by-case basis and what the client wants to do. I mean, I'm getting more and more calls from people who are looking for someone who has been successful in fiduciary litigation cases, lawsuits, from really all across the state. That's just kind of like, I guess, because I've been doing it a long time and that's, you know, developed to that point. So we certainly consider cases, depending on the circumstances, you know, all over the state.
Wow.
This particular person who called yesterday was calling from probably 4 hours away, relative to an estate administration. And actually she had gotten my name from a juror who sat on a jury in Onslow County in a fiduciary case that I tried in December.
Wow.
And she said that the juror recommended calling me, and that's how that spun into that. So at any rate, you know, Cecil's right. I mean, in many estate administration cases, you end up not really necessarily needing an attorney. I think it's almost always advisable to seek advice on the front end of an estate administration and let that attorney tell you whether you need an attorney or not. Okay. In this particular case, there were concerns regarding an estate administration where basically the estate had been pending for I'm not sure how long. It was pretty long, maybe a year or so. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things had happened. So as I'm talking to the person on the phone, she also indicated that she had listened to the radio program. She had listened to that on our website. Mm-hmm. And we had answered a lot of her questions that she had. Wow. Just through one of our programs. So right. Good job, Blackwood. You asked good questions.
Thank you.
So, but she wanted to fill in the gaps with regard to some things. I'm not going to use names or right. go into any real detail, but there was, you know, concern with regard to an attorney who's representing the estate and some of the things that attorney had done and some of the tactics she had used and some of the, she was kind of bending over backwards to help the executor of the estate, who was also a creditor of the estate. For example, there was supposedly a fraudulent loan. It wasn't a real loan. There was the money that changed hands, and it was a document that had a lot of questions around it. And there was apparently a hearing about whether that would be something that would be paid to this beneficiary / executor. And it appeared as though that the attorney represented both the estate and the creditor, the claimant, in that proceeding. So, I mean, that right from the beginning is a conflict of interest.
Right.
And so there's a problem there. There was a problem with the primary beneficiary, who was not the person who called me. It was like the person who called me was calling on behalf of this primary beneficiary. Mm-hmm. And she had filed a lot of things with the clerk of court's office that were very misdirected. It's like she didn't have legal counsel, but she was upset about what was going on. So she was bringing up all these issues before the clerk of court by filing these various and numerous motions that are outside of the jurisdiction of what the clerk of court can consider.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a confusing issue with the person who called me, and I hope that I helped her with that. But unfortunately, the filing of all of these things led to a motion by this attorney that I've already identified, not by name, just by their position.
Right.
For filing a Rule 11 sanctions motion. And all lawyers know what Rule 11 is. Rule 11 is if you file something that's not well-grounded in fact or well-grounded in law, then you may get popped by the court. You may get sanctioned by doing that. That could be the attorney that's sanctioned or the party that's sanctioned. And so because these things were not well-grounded in law, or in fact, according to what I looked at online when I pulled up the file, the clerk of court entered an order after a hearing sanctioning this beneficiary who had filed all these things.
Right.
So basically, there are assets at play here. There's real property times two. There's money. There's things here that are going to pass to this beneficiary. And the beneficiary wants to make sure she receives everything she's entitled to.
Right.
But she's already kind of set herself up for being very limited in what the clerk of court is going to do for her. I mean, the will is going to pass the way the will is going to pass the assets the way it's going to pass. But the proper way to deal with a lot of the things that this person was complaining about is not the way it was done, and now she's kind of tainted herself with the court. So, you know, my advice at the end of this hour-long conversation and going through the court file and kind of untangling everything that had been done was I can't tell you exactly what needs to be done until I review this entire file, and there was a partition proceeding from property that passed through the estate. Mm-hmm. And review that entire file, and then we can take a look at these multiple issues. And so I quoted a small amount of money to pay as a retainer for us to review all of that, so that you know I'm not just kind of going off the cuff, but I'm giving good proper advice after good proper concentration and analysis.
Right,
and so. You know, and there were some assumptions during this conversation as well that, well, this ship has sailed and that ship has sailed. That's what the person said multiple times, like the promissory note that's in question, the determination by the clerk on that. Well, and there's an assumption that that's already done. Well, no, that's not the case. You would be able to, in many cases, again, this is one of those things I'd have to look at more closely about what actually happened, what notice was given, what action was filed. We would be able to file a declaratory judgment action in Superior Court for the court to determine whether that is a legitimate debt or not. So there's other ways to kind of skin the cat to go through the process that the average person, is not going to understand.
Right.
So my ultimate advice was I can review everything. I'm happy to help. It's okay that it's 4 hours away. You know, we can cross that bridge when we get to it. And this is the retainer amount, which is a small amount to review everything. And then we'll go from there. And it may be that I'm referring you to someone who I know in that area who I would trust to handle this going forward. But the better plan for these people would have been to have competent legal counsel from the beginning.
Wes,
and sometimes people don't have money to pay an attorney from the beginning.
Right.
But you know, if the estate has some assets in it and they're all passing to this person, you know, in many cases, I will agree that, okay, we'll just be paid on the back end.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't do that every time because obviously, we have cash needs to flow, and we have a business to run, and we have people to pay and employees to pay, and so on and so forth. I don't want to do that every time, but in some circumstances we will do that, and that would have been one of those circumstances. So I hate this for these people that the train has gone down the wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
But in this particular situation, I think that we can divert this train back onto the right track. But unfortunately, it probably take a little bit of doing to do it, and that doing is going to cost a little bit of money, and that could have been avoided if they had the right, legal counsel, period, right from the beginning.
And sometimes, Lockwood, this is just kind of like Murphy's Law, something just got off track.
Right.
We have a file in our office right now where a gentleman died. It was a blended marriage. He had children from a prior marriage. She then has her children. They were married for quite some time. He died and appointed his wife, which is typical, as executor. She came in and retained us, and we are in the middle, if you will, or maybe not even the middle, actually. We're about a third of the way in assisting and administering that estate on her behalf as the surviving spouse. Well, lo and behold, which is very sad, she gets very sick.
Uh-huh.
She is then hospitalized, and I then get a telephone call that she has passed on. So now that estate, we will have to petition for a new executor because the pending executor that has the order of executorship, the letters testamentary, which we've talked about, mm-hmm. has the authority to settle the estate, has passed on. So now our office, we need a new executor. Well, these are the kinds of things that can throw a clerk of court. It's a little bit different than what Wes is referring to, but one person is in today, a different person is in tomorrow. Things change, and in the process of this, the file at the clerk's office can become can get out of line very quickly,
mm-hmm.
If we aren't careful. So it happens where the clerk becomes bewildered, gets, as I say, the train gets off the track a bit, and then our job is to get it back on the track. The clerks are, Wes, of course, has an outstanding reputation with all of our judges and clerks of court, and he does do the hearings and the presentations of facts before the judicial the clerks and mm-hmm. the judges. And what I'm leading up to here is that the clerks are extremely helpful and appreciative of good lawyering.
Right.
They appreciate a lawyer that will come to a hearing and explain, how this train got off the track a bit, mm-hmm. Madam Clerk, and how we think we can get it back on track. And for instance, this file that I'm handling, Madam Clerk, the executor has died. The will does not appoint an alternate executor, so we're in a bit of a dilemma here. But this is what we suggest, because after all, we have an estate to settle. There's
right.
a 90-day inventory. There's a final accounting to file within a year, and we can't just, we've got to qualify a new executor. And of course, there happen to be children from the husband's side. There are children from the mother's side, or from the wife's side, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And so who is that executor going to be? That's going to require some discussion in front of the clerk of court, if you will, or either in comprehensive letters to make the clerk comfortable with appointing a new executor. But we really do, it's kind of a win-win. We really appreciate the clerks of court. We are so appreciative of all that they do, and they appreciate all that we do. And we work together hand in hand on all of these files.
I want to go back to some issues here, and I think this is the important aspect of this. And I just want to make a quick personal comment, and that is a simple phone call 252 area code 726-9050. A simple phone call at the very outset, as we've just heard from both Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, that will eliminate not only a great deal, I think, of personal stress, financial stress, but a waste of time, too. And that's the other aspect of all of this. Things have to move quickly. You know, I want to go back to several items. I want to touch on the topic of fiduciary responsibility here in a moment. But first, I want to go to the question of the sanction, the Rule 11, the sanction motion. And I'm wondering, Cecil, Wes, recognizing that obviously this particular beneficiary has been sanctioned by, I gather, the clerk of court. Is there a way to, I'm going to say, soften that, ameliorate that, remove that problem? Is that something that can be done? Would that happen if, for example, that individual does get, such as you, legal representation to step in and say, okay, Lockwood has been sanctioned. However, I Wes, or I, Cecil, am representing him. Let's talk about this. What is there a way to solve that small, I'm going to say, that hurdle?
Yes, there's a way to soften it and maybe a way to eliminate the effect of it completely.
Wow.
You start with the order that was entered by the clerk to determine what the sanction was.
Okay.
And the main thing you want to look at with regard to Rule 11 sanctions, or really any type of sanction order, is, at least what I want to look at first, is was my client popped for some type of money? Were they taxed attorney's fees? Were they taxed costs? Were something where they have to pay that because of, you know, their actions they took may have cost other people in the litigation money, the moving party for the Rule 11. I mean, that typically is what you're seeing when there's a Rule 11. Some of the other relief that you normally see in a Rule 11 could be things like striking your answer so that you basically are at the mercy of the court with regard to what the other side is doing. I mean, that's kind of that's an aggressive sanction, but it's allowed. In this sanction, it was more of a gatekeeper type order. Basically, it actually included some determination by the clerk that I think that aren't allowed by law.
Okay.
But so there's that. You know, you have a right for any order of the clerk of court to appeal it.
Uh-huh.
And then it goes up to the Superior Court we have two statutes that deal with that when you're dealing with clerk orders, whether it's a special proceeding type case like a partition or whether it's an estate. It's two different standards. It's under 1-301. That's just where it is in the statute. So then that goes up to Superior Court. You've got a 30-day period of time to file the notice of appeal. So you can do that, and that's almost, in most cases, it's like a do-over. Sometimes it's a record review of what was done. Sometimes it's de novo and new evidence before the Superior Court. But there are ways to deal with that. But kind of piggybacking on what Cecil was saying, if the sanction really isn't anything that is too serious, like if my client is not sanctioned, there's no sanction for my client to pay money, and we can live with the language of the sanction. Probably one of the best things to do is to, you know, file your notice of appearance in the case. You know, next hearing, you're there representing the party.
Uh-huh.
You're fully prepared. You are showing that you're going to work with the clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're going to follow law specifically,
mm-hmm.
because what has gotten us to this point is that there's been a lack of following law.
Right.
There's been almost arguably frivolous
right.
things that have been filed. I don't think that there was any attempt to, you know, punish anybody or there was any punitive intent behind these filings, although there may have been some frustration behind them. It was just the filings were done by a pro se litigant, one without an attorney. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the train got off the track.
I understood.
So the clerk of court would appreciate a good attorney,
okay,
who's going to come in and right, not just kind of, you know, raise H-E-L-L about what did what happened, but instead, you know, kind of say, okay, clerk, I understand what you did. I got it. We're not going to go down that track again. My client was just off. She didn't understand that. I'm here now. We're going to follow the law with regard to this.
Thereby not
that doesn't mean I'm going to agree on right, what everybody else says that we're doing, or even what the clerk's doing, but we're going to do it as per law, and we could still have a, you know, a somewhat of an adversarial process, but it be done properly.
Right.
So I think most clerks, especially experienced clerks, appreciate that and would see that as a relief. Good. Thank goodness we're not dealing with these,
right,
wait, you know, off motions, these, you know, being off track, that right, kind of thing.
Not wasting time. And that's another issue. All right. One other quick question for you. And this really caught my attention. A beneficiary who happens to also be a creditor an executor of the estate. I saw that and flags went up instantly, and I'm wondering, this goes back to the fiduciary responsibilities and fiduciary law. That's one of those things that I would think that an attorney, when looking at an estate, would say, wait a second, we've got some potential conflicts. Am I thinking correctly on that, Cecil? Yes.
Well, the conflict there was not with the person being a creditor of the estate, because that happens all the time. For example, the executor might use their own money to pay the funeral.
Okay.
And they're entitled to be reimbursed.
All right.
The problem was that it became somewhat adversarial, and it's my understanding that the attorney who represented the estate also put in paper on the pleading that she represented the creditor as well for that claim. So individually, so you can, that if that in fact was the case, which I think it was from what I saw, that there is a misunderstanding as to the fiduciary responsibility of an attorney for the estate compared to an attorney who has a claim against the estate.
Okay,
and that's just, you know, kind of a very black letter with regard to the rules of professional conduct. You can't wear both hats there. Now, if the person who had the claim against the estate, you know, the who happens to be the executor, just files a claim against the estate pro se without an attorney, then that's fine. There's no problem with that.
Okay.
It's just that the attorney was kind of overstepping, and the attorney, I think, represents one of the individuals in the partition proceeding. So there's, you know, there's. The attorney representing the estate looks like that she's doing a little too much.
Okay,
that's a nice way to put
it. Okay, all right. One final question for you before we wrap things up, and we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And again, the conclusion of all of this, as I prepare to ask this question, and that is ask advice. Simply make a phone call. All right. What do you mean by partition? Very quickly.
Yeah, the partition was, this happens in the states all the time. Basically, a piece of real estate was owned in part by the decedent in this particular estate I was talking about.
Uh-huh.
And so it passed, I'm not sure what the percentages were, but I think it was like 25% each. So that property passes immediately upon death. And then a separate action was brought by one of the owners to divide the property because it was acreage. There
okay,
was right, multiple acres. So that's a division in kind, basically, to divide the property out in quarters, 25% each.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so commissioners have to be appointed. This is through the clerk of court's office as well, to determine what a fair division of the property would be.
Okay.
And so they would have to file their report, and then if you object to what they say the division would be, then you have a right to object. There's uh-huh, further hearings. It could go to Superior Court. There's a process you go through. So that happens a lot in the states. And if you're very quickly here, I know we're running out of time, but if the property can't be divided in kind, let's say it's just a house on a lot, it can't be divided four ways. then that's going to default into a petition to partition by sale,
okay,
which can be a private sale, which is just like listing it with a realtor, but the commissioner sells it. That's an appointed fiduciary. Or it could be a public sale, which normally we try to shy away from because we want a private sale so we can test the market and get as much as we can for the property.
Right.
And so that's just a forced sale based on the parties not wanting to continue to hold the property in a tenants in common posture among multiple owners.
All right. I think this is an important conversation we've had today with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell. Cecil, of course, started the program. We're talking about the responsibility of estate management, estate settlements, and the responsibilities and the activities associated with the clerk of courts, which our hosts have identified are capable of doing the job. However, it does pay at the outset. Simply ask a question. Call your attorney. And in fact, I'm going to suggest call Harvell and Collins, that's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, 252 area code 726-9050, and go online to harvellandcollins.com, spell out the word and as well, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Just real quick, one sentence, a little feeder for next week. I hear the topic already, which is what happens when heirs do inherit a piece of property. Who pays the mortgage? Who pays the light bill? Who pays the utilities? And then what happens to the house if the heirs can't agree to sell it? And who pays all these expenses in the meantime? That's a very, very sensitive subject and very complicated in our office. Estate funds are not funds to pay for the upkeep of real property. We'll discuss that later next week.
Outstanding. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins here on Let's Talk Legal.